Hi, I'm Dr. Kathy Miller, Professor of Medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Welcome to Medscape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the 2017 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. For patients with hormone-sensitive disease, 5 years is not a very good benchmark. In fact, more patients have a recurrence after 5 years than in that first 5 years. Those late recurrences have been a vexing problem for decades, and I've asked my next guest, Dr. Joe Sperano, to give us some recent insights about who might be at greatest risk. Joe is professor of oncology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and associate chair of the Department of Oncology at the Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, New York. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Dr. Miller.
So tell us how you first got interested in this problem of late relapse.
Well, as a clinician, it's a problem, you know, that I face every day in my clinic, a frustrating one, especially for the patients who've been through the entire process of surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and 5 years of hormone therapy. And generally, people celebrate, right, after 5 years because they feel that they've completed their therapy. But unfortunately, as you know, for patients, and I think as is becoming more and more appreciated, patients who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer are at risk for late relapse beyond 5 years. And recent studies have shown that there is some small benefit by continuing endocrine therapy beyond 5 years, but there's side effects, as you know, associated with that. So we really need a biomarker to identify who might be most likely to benefit from that.
So I think that problem of late recurrence really got elevated in our consciousness with those studies of longer-term hormone therapy. We still see patients who think at 5 years, I'm done, I'm home free. It's always a difficult discussion with them to have to remind them their risk is not down to zero. In fact, it continues for a long time. And for many of those patients, longer-duration hormone therapy, it's a tough sell. There's costs, there's toxicity. The benefits are pretty small.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's sort of two forces that are converging. One is that we've known for many years, at least 20 years, about the risk of late relapse. It was actually one of our colleagues, Tom Safner, who published a study in the Journal of Clinical Oncology illustrating that possibly for the first time. And then more recently, there's been a meta-analysis that's been published demonstrating that on a large-scale basis and really nailing it down quantitatively in terms of what the risk is. We thought that we can deal with that issue by just developing better therapies to use up front, but those have been helpful in reducing early recurrence but not necessarily impacting later recurrence.
So that's particularly been true of chemotherapy in our hormone-positive patients. It reduces that early peak of recurrence but has very little impact on those recurrences that happen after year five.
Absolutely, and of course, one of the key issues is that there's a large subset of patients with ER-positive disease who don't benefit at all from chemotherapy. So trying to find the sweet spot is what the challenge has been.
So tell us about the biobank that you helped develop to give us the samples to try to tackle this question of what drives late recurrence and who might be at risk.
Sure. Well, this was an idea that started about 5 or so years ago, as I think we all became more concerned about this issue of late recurrence. So our colleagues at ECOG Akron conceived of this idea and came up with the idea of leveraging existing federally funded trials in patients who were being followed anyway long-term and trying to capture those patients who were without evidence of recurrence for 5 years, again, who we were following anyway, and collect biospecimens from them. And fortunately, we were able to leverage funding from both the BCRF, the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, and the Komen Foundation to support establishing this biobank. And we're now starting to bear some of the fruits of that effort.
So it's a very pragmatic approach. Many of the costs are decreased because these patients are going to be followed anyhow as part of the existing trials. I would assume that those existing trials also collected their initial tumors when they enrolled in the parent trial, so we'll have the potential to look at predictors of late recurrence even from the beginning, but also whether things might change, because it may be that evolution over time is what drives late recurrence.
Yeah, I think we sort of are pigeonholed into this notion of there being one decision point in a patient's cancer trajectory. And that decision point is at the time of diagnosis as it relates to their surgery, their radiation, their chemotherapy, their endocrine therapy, and their anti-HER2 therapy. But we now may be reaching a point with our ability to evaluate tumor biology through blood sampling, either through circulating tumor DNA or circulating tumor cells, to get prognostic and possibly predictive information, so that perhaps we should start thinking about a second decision point 5 years after therapy, after diagnosis, to tailor therapy further.
Now you're presenting some of the first results of actually using samples from this biobank. Tell us about those first analyses.
Sure. So, again, we leveraged samples from an existing clinical trial, the E5103 trial, which you know very well, which evaluated the role of bevacizumab as a component of adjuvant therapy added to chemotherapy. The trial did not meet its primary endpoint, but this, I think, is an example of how clinical trials can provide very useful information even when they may not meet their primary endpoint. And so we took those patients, as I described, who were recurrence-free at about 5 years. We collected a biospecimen from them, mainly from the blood, including a circulating tumor cell assay. We accrued 547 patients over a period of about 3.5 years. And then about a year after we closed the study to accrual, we took our first look at the data.
So this is, I think, a scary thought. The idea that someone 5 years from diagnosis, after that full 5-year standard therapy, would have a circulating tumor cell detectable. I think many of our listeners must imagine we didn't find anything. We didn't find circulating tumor cells. So how common was it, and did it matter?
Sure. Well, in patients with metastatic breast cancer, where the assay is commercially available and FDA cleared, we know that about 60% of patients have detectable circulating tumor cells, and that the presence of a high burden of circulating tumor cells is prognostic. That's point number one. Point number two, we know from earlier stage disease in patients who've had surgery but have not yet had adjuvant chemotherapy, that about 20% of patients have detectable circulating tumor cells. And we do know that the presence of those cells provides independent prognostic information. So there's clinical validity with that association, but not clinical utility, because there's not really much we can do to act upon it.
And at that point, those patients who've just had surgery, they've not yet had any systemic therapy. So you might also wonder if those patients who have a circulating tumor cell at that point are the ones who really need our systemic therapies, hopefully
yes.
The ones who really derive greater benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But this study was looking 5 years down the road. Could we still detect circulating tumor cells at that time point?
Well, our hypothesis was that we would see a detection rate of about 5 to 10%, and we designed the study to distinguish that versus a rate of less than 1%. And we built in an early stopping rule to stop if we had a very low detection rate of less than 1%. When we did our interim analysis, we found that that it wasn't less than 1%, so we were able to continue. And when we did the final analysis, we found that about 5% of patients had detectable circulating tumor cells, which was the first study objective, is just to get a sense of what that prevalence was at that particular time point.
Now, any obvious clinical factors? You know, more extensive disease, biologically more aggressive disease, that predicted finding a circulating tumor cell at roughly year 5?
The simple answer is no. The more complex answer is when we did a multivariate analysis looking at tumor size, nodal status, grade, estrogen receptor expression, or use of endocrine therapy in patients who had hormone receptor positive disease. There were no differences between the CTC positive and the CTC negative group. So they couldn't be picked out on the basis of clinical features.
So that potentially makes the assay more important. It's potentially really frightening for someone who sees patients in clinic to think that we really can't distinguish on clinical grounds that ongoing risk. What was the risk associated with finding a CTC?
Well, we were expecting there to be an increased risk, right? I mean, that was the hypothesis that was driving the study. But the level of risk stratification was really pretty striking. There was a 20-fold higher risk of recurrence in those who were CTC positive compared with those who were CTC negative. And the follow-up of the study was relatively short for estrogen receptor positive disease, but substantial in that we could estimate 2-year recurrence rates. And so the positive predictive value for a positive test was 35% at 2 years. So 35%.
So if you had a positive test, 1 in 3 women recurred within the next 2 years.
Yes. And that's obviously a very important finding and raises the question as to whether we should be using this as a biomarker to identify high-risk patients to possibly test other strategies to reduce risk.
So the second decision point you were mentioning. Maybe this is a test you do at that point to identify patients who have secondary adjuvant therapy or some other intervention to reduce
I think
that
that's
risk.
A very important component of it, but perhaps an equally or more important component of it is the negative predictive value of the test. So the negative predictive value was 98%, meaning that only 2% of patients who had a negative test had a recurrence by 2 years, which means is that we might be able to use this as a biomarker to spare the continued use of extended adjuvant therapy. Bear in mind that in the low-risk registry of TAILOR-X, the 5-year risk of distant recurrence was 1%, which was deemed sufficiently low enough that clinicians and experts felt they didn't need to do a randomized trial in that setting to demonstrate that you didn't need chemotherapy. Here we're dealing with a different situation. We're not dealing with a toxic chemotherapy regimen. We're talking about continuing an existing regimen that someone's been on, an orally administered drug. But many patients do have issues tolerating the drugs for this one. There are toxicities.
There are bone health concerns.
Yeah. So I think patients would spare the opportunity to stop their therapy if they felt they could do it in a safe way.
So these really are striking results, but not yet ready for people to go home and start looking for CTCs in their long-term follow-up patients. Where do you take this next to get us to that point?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think people confuse clinical validity, and this study provides level one evidence showing clinical validity, that is the association of this biomarker with recurrence, but that doesn't always translate into clinical utility. That is, does the information provided by the test provide additional prognostic information? Does treatment change as a result of that? And do patients benefit from that change, which is the most important factor? So I think we're on solid ground with the clinical validity part, but we will need to do more studies to establish what the clinical utility of this is.
So I describe this to patients as if you do the test now, you've told me to worry more or worry less. You didn't tell me what to do about it. Mm-hmm. That would change how much we need to worry about you.
Yeah.
So that's going to have to be the next step, is to look at interventions in this group and other biomarkers, because we have a lot more material in the bank.
Yeah, this may not be the only biomarker. First of all, we only assess the CTCs at one time point. The assay may have greater negative predictive value if we assay at serial time points, say after the completion of endocrine therapy. We can use it in combination with other biomarkers such as circulating tumor DNA, looking for specific mutations, for example, in ESR1 that might indicate that patients may respond better to a different type of anti-estrogen therapy. So there's quite a bit of work to do, but I think the results of the study lay sort of a foundation for doing that work in a more enlightened way.
Well, thank you, Joe, for joining us. And the biobank really is going to teach us so much over the next several years. Thank you for coming to share these first results.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
And to you, our audience, thank you for joining us as well. This is Dr. Kathy Miller reporting from San Antonio.